Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Today we're joined by Dr. John Trepagan and his new book, The Blood of Gotoku, a Jack Ridley Mystery in Japan. It was published by Ballester Press this year. John is an anthropologist studying and teaching about culture, religion, and ruralities in Japan at the University of Texas, Austin. This book is actually a novel, something we don't see very often on our Japanese Studies channel, but John has a good reason for it. So, John, how about we start by talking about your choice of publishing your research results in the form of a novel?
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me on the channel. I'm looking very forward to our conversation. It's an interesting question. I think part of the reason I chose to do this is because I'm bored with academic publishing. It's just the same thing kind of over and over again. And I've been doing it for 30 years. And so I wanted to try something different, something that would be a little bit more challenging. But there are also some academic reasons for what I chose to do with this. One of the things that I think as an ethnographer, one of the things you find is that when you're writing up your research, there are always these moments where you think, am I just making this up, or is this really what happened here? Because you are telling a story. It's you're describing the people and the place, but it's all being filtered through my eyes and my thinking. And I try to have the voices of my interlocutors, come through in my writing, but it's still me picking what matters. And so I thought, well, rather than worrying about that, why don't I just write fiction and see what happens? And so I think ethnography kind of lives at the intersection of fiction and nonfiction. I don't think it's overtly one or the other. And I decided to just pull this all the way over into the side of fiction and see if I could write something ethnographic, but write it around a story that's fiction. So the content, almost everything in it is right out of my field notes with some exceptions. But the story, of course, is something I just made up. And the other thing that motivated me with this is that, increasingly over the last 20 years, 30 years, ethnographic work has become very theoretical. It's very difficult for undergraduates to wade through. A lot of it's really boring and tedious. I look at old ethnographies and some of them are just a lot of fun to read. You really learn a lot about another place and they're accessible. And a lot of what's written today is not very accessible. And so I wanted to write something that, undergraduates could use, just anybody interested in Japan could use and learn more than just, a travel log, something that's got more depth to it. But place it in that framework of fiction to make it a little bit more interesting to work through and read and get what one can get out of it. So those are the things that kind of pushed me to give this a try.
That makes sense. And I guess it's quite a luxury to be able to say that you got bored of academia after spending 30 years, considering I haven't even really stepped my foot in it.
But well, I'm old.
Now, with this novel, you can add another title of novelist,
I guess.
Novel writer. And more than just an anthropologist. So what else intrigues you? I understand you have a lot of other interests.
Yes, I have a very short attention span, which has always been one of my problems. And so I tend to flit from topic to topic. Very broadly, I've been interested in the intersection of culture, religion, and science throughout my career. All three of those things have been interesting to me. I was trained as a medical anthropologist at the University of Pittsburgh. My early work all dealt with the cultural construction of senile dementia in Japan. I also looked at elder suicide and some other topics. And then, I don't know, around 15 years ago, I, again, probably because I was getting a little bit bored, I decided to pursue something completely different. I grew up in the 1960s in the era of Star Trek and the Apollo space program. And I've always been in love with the idea of space exploration. And so I was reading some things and found myself intrigued with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And, you know, you've got a group of astronomers who are, you know, listening to the heavens, hoping that ET will contact us, and ET never contacts us. So maybe ET's not there, who knows. But from my perspective, I was interested in kind of as a form of cultural production and as a sort of representation of ideals about humanity and life. I got interested in how these astronomers and others sort of conceptualized what they were doing. And out of that, I kind of developed another whole research strain that looks at the culture and ethics of space exploration, and have been pretty involved in that over the last several years. I've done things, you know, looking at kind of how, in some ways, the that search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, has similarities with religion. And I've also done some work related to questions like, you know, what are the ethical questions around colonizing Mars and that kind of stuff. So all of it, somehow in my head, all of these things come together. And are related, but it does look kind of like I have two very distinct streams of research over the course of my career.
That's wonderful. And let's not forget, you're also a co-host for the New Books Network, and you're also active on many channels. So what channels do you co-host for?
Oh, yeah, well, I primarily got involved with this through the Science, Technology, and Society channel, and have done quite a few books for that channel. And then the East Asia channel and the Japanese Studies channel, of course, are areas where I've done things. And so I find the New Books Network to be just a wonderful project and you know, a great way to really explore all of the wonderful writing that's going on these days.
I totally agree. Mm. Now, in the introduction of the novel, you mentioned that this book, this novel, is the fruit of your anthropologist research. Can you tell us more about your research project?
Yeah, well, so as I said, I started out doing work on how people think about the onset of cognitive decline in old age in Japan as a cultural category, not as just a disease category, although that was certainly part of it. And along with that, it was almost unavoidable that I would become interested in looking at issues related to population decline in rural areas. Japan, of course, is undergoing a rather complex and interesting process right now as their population is shrinking. And it's the rural areas where I do my research are at the leading edge of this. So the town where I do my research, I think right now about 35% of the population is over 65. And that will be over 50% in a few years. And so, you know, you think about that, and, you know, one in every three people you meet is over 65. And so as I, you know, I continued doing work on that, I got interested in religion and how older people kind of engage in religious practice to sort of how it intersects with ideas about well-being. I wound up writing a book about that. And then most recently, there's been a lot of talk about sort of decline in the population and decline in rural areas, and it never looked like that to me. I mean, it's obvious that the population is shrinking, but I see a great deal of vitality and a lot of creativity in what people are trying to sort of invent and create to make their world sustainable in rural areas. And so a few years ago, I got interested in a study of entrepreneurs in rural Japan. And it started around a question of why would you go start a business in a place that's losing population? And the answers to that turned out to be quite interesting. There were things like looking for self-fulfillment, looking to do something meaningful, wanting to move, you know, back to an area that had a slower pace, ideas like that. And, you know, most of my recent research related to Japan has been focused on that. The research that's behind the novel takes all of that into account. Basically, what I did was I mined my field notes really right from the beginning of my doing field work and used the stories, the people, the ideas and things that run through my field notes as a basis for creating a structure for the novel. And so in a sense, the novel kind of brings together my research over the course of now almost 30 years. So it's many different projects that are sort of floating around in that.
Wow. So did you mean your field notes from the entire 30 years of your research?
Well, I didn't use them all, of course, but I basically went through different aspects of my field notes to build the characters. So the all of the Japanese characters are real people in the book. Sometimes they're composites of a few different people. Sometimes they're very much just, you know, actual people I know. And of course, their names are changed and I do things to try to, you know, cover their identities. But these are, you know, actual people that I've interacted with and they're, you know, stories about them are in my field notes, experiences that I've had with them. And so I drew on that as a basis for both describing the people and the place. And also talking about some of the stories that arise in the course of the try to build a story out of my field notes. Now, field notes, you know, I mean, I have vast amounts of field notes. I probably have 3,000 pages of typed field notes. And so, you know, I'm picking and choosing things as I work through that.
That's wonderful. And could you give us an overview, without too much spoiler, of the plot of the novel?
Yeah, so it follows the main character, Jack Ridley, who's an anthropologist. It actually starts in the United States. He's a professor at Yale, and it starts with him at his retirement dinner. And that's a sort of a sub-theme that runs through the story is Jack, as he's thinking about this transition that happens as you move from having a career to being retired. And sort of the basis of your life changes. And this comes out of my research because I talked to a lot of people about this when I was doing work on aging in Japan. And that transition can be quite difficult for some people. And so I wanted to use that as a way to explore that side of things a little bit. And then he moves to Japan. His wife is Japanese. And so he moves to Japan because she wants to get out of the United States, which is quite understandable. And remember, this was written in part, I guess, well, it was still written maybe when Trump was president. But he goes there and they've set up their house in this little village. And it gets into kind of his life of adjustment to this place again after having not been there for a while. But then what I wanted to do with this is create a story that would get into the head of the ethnographer a little bit. And from my perspective, an ethnographer is kind of a detective. You're solving puzzles. You're trying to make sense out of what's going on around you. So I decided to have it be a murder mystery. And so he encounters the murderer. I don't want to go into too much about that side of things. It explores a little bit of his friendship with a local Buddhist monk and then kind of works through the process of solving the mystery, but also working through that in relation to Japanese culture and understanding rural culture and this sort of thing. So that's really how the book is kind of structured as a story. And so, you know, the mystery, If you're an ethnographer, you're interested in solving mysteries. And so all I did was said, well, let's make it a real mystery, you know, kind of a murder mystery type mystery. And then you can kind of follow that process.
So is it safe to assume that this Jack Ridley figure is based on you, or at least a part of you?
Yeah, it's pretty safe to say. It's not all me, but what I was trying to accomplish with the character is to give the reader something of a window into the mind of an ethnographer. And there's only one ethnographer's mind I actually know, and that's my own. And so what I did was I built it kind of around my own experiences. And you know, some of the things are very much, I mean, my wife is Japanese, and I do, you know, both of my children kind of show up in there very briefly. And so, you know, there are things from my life that are very much a part of it. But then, you know, I haven't run into any murders when I've been in Japan. And so, you know, that part of it's very much not real. But the character is in many ways sort of structured around aspects of my own experience and personality, I would say.
Okay, that's one thing I was really curious about was the thrilling part, the murders. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with these murder plots based on your field notes, or how do they relate to actual events that happened during your research?
Yeah. So the objects that are used in the murder are all real objects. They're things that I have encountered. And again, I don't want to, you know, go too much detail into it because it might spoil it. But all of that is, you know, I've basically taken the material culture that I've experienced as I've done ethnography there and tried to work that into the way in which the murders happen. And it does, the mode of murder, for example, reflects things that happen in Japan. And so I was trying to, you know, capture some of those types of things. I think I lost track of my thinking on this a little bit, but it's, the structure of the story itself is kind of, there are a lot of things that happen in it that really have happened to me. Let's put it that way. Even though they have no relationship to a murder or anything like that. But, and a lot of the sort of backstory surrounding the questions of who the murderer is, that stuff's real. There are real things going on there. And so, you know, for example, the Jehovah's Witness show up. That actually is all very real. The village I lived in when I was doing my dissertation field work, there was a Jehovah's Witness meeting house in the middle of it. It was very strange because that's not something you expect to find in rural Japan. But there was an old empty house there and they had rented that out, I guess. And they would come by to my door quite often because they were intrigued with me because as an American, they would come and they would say, oh, you're from a Christian country. Don't you want to come and join us? And I would talk to them a bit and then say, well, I'm kind of busy. But, you know, there was this kind of, it was a really intriguing group of people in a sense, because they were rather atypical of most of the people that I would run across in my field work. And so they show up in the novel and they're there because I really experienced that and experienced their interactions when I was doing field work in the 1990s.
That's fascinating. And I especially liked the part about this ritual of kakushi nenbutsu or mm-hmm. kakure nenbutsu. Can you tell us what it is and what its historical background is? And what does it have to do with Jehovah's Witnesses?
Not much to do with Jehovah's Witnesses, except the way that I sort of weave them together in a story. And in that sense, they're really separate things. But Kakushi Nenbutsu is it's a ritual that was done throughout that area for a long time. I don't know how far back it goes. I'm not a historian, so I've never really tried to explore the depth of how long it's been around. But most of the older people that I've spoken with went through it when they were children. And it was a ritual that happened, I think, around 5 years old or so, maybe a little older, in which they would put the children in a room where they blacked out all the windows with curtains. And then the leader would bring a candle around and put it right in front of the face of each child. And the child, if the child would like cry or get upset, then they failed. And the purpose of all this, kakushi means hidden, or kakure means hidden or secret. And this was done originally at a time when Zen temples dominated the area, and the Nembutsu is associated with Shin Buddhism, and that was done underground because they weren't supposed to do that. So this is hundreds of years ago. And so they did it in secret. And it was basically an initiation into being a member of the cult of the blood of Gutoku, which means foolish bald-headed one, which refers to Shinran, who was one of the great thinkers of Japanese Buddhism and the founder of Jodo Shinshu. And so the practice itself is now largely gone. I think there are still a few places where it may happen. Younger parents didn't want their children going through that following World War II. They thought it was kind of brutal. And also with the decline in the number of children, that has made it harder and harder to carry on rituals like that. And so the last time I talked to anybody about it was probably in the early 2000s. And I remember the guy I was talking to, whose brother was the head of one group, said it was dying out because the combination of not enough children and not much interest on the part of parents. So I think if it's not completely gone now, it probably won't be around that much longer.
So would you consider aging as one of the most important factors that it's slowly dying out?
Well, yes. I mean, the process of change going on in Japan in general and rural Japan in particular is very much tied with the demographics. And you've got a very aged population at this point in time. And of course, they have memories of this, but they're not going to be around that much longer. And so with them will go the memories of this, since younger generations haven't really been too engaged in it. Only a few people have. And so I think that's contributing to this change, is that you just aren't going to, you know, I think there are still pockets where it's where it happens. But it may also turn into something like other rituals have in Japan, where it becomes more of a kind of a heritage and folk tradition type thing, rather than an actual initiation ritual, which is what it was until, you know, maybe 20 years ago.
Now, how rural was this area that you were studying about, and how rural, let's say, how different is it in the novel comparing to your where you did your field work?
Well, the place is where I did my field work, and so it's the same. To describe it, rural is a very hard word to use in Japan. Japan is in essence an urban society. So this is a place that's several hundred kilometers north of Tokyo. It is an agricultural area. It's characterized by rice farming and also dairy farming. But the thing is that you've got, you know, people, younger people, and by what I mean, people maybe 60 and down, and even some older than that, are actually quite cosmopolitan. Many of them have traveled to other parts of the world. They, you know, have lived in Tokyo or some other big city in Japan. So it's got this kind of cosmopolitan aspect to it. At the same time, it retains some of what are, you know, conceptualized as traditional values. That's, I think, a kind of can of worms, because what exactly is traditional? But certainly they try to retain a feel of rusticness, if you want to put it that way. But it's a very complicated place. And it was that way when I was there in the 1990s and again in the early 2000s. And I've been back every summer basically since, except during the pandemic. So it's, you know, to kind of answer that, how rural is it? It's actually a very hard, it's a very difficult question to answer, because it has aspects to it that feel very rural, and then other aspects that feel very cosmopolitan. And so it's a, I actually view it as kind of a hybrid space where it's really kind of neither exactly rustic nor cosmopolitan. It's both at the same time. But in the mind of Japanese, it's very rural. Most people in Japan would look at it as one of the most sort of rural places in Japan. The Tohoku region is the upper six prefectures on the main island of Honshu, and they are typically perceived of as being kind of ultra rural in the, you know, kind of public discourse on what Japan is, even though that's a little too simplistic, but that's how they're often viewed.
That's a great point. And when you were there observing them, other than Kakushi Nenbutsu, and we also mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses, what other kinds of, I guess, religious practices did you observe that may be a unique characteristic of rural areas?
Well, it's a little hard for me to answer because I've never really done much research in an urban area. So Kakushi Nenbutsu is also kind of tied to just the Nenbutsu, which is something that gets done when someone dies. They have the funeral, and then the night of the funeral, they do the Nenbutsu, where it's done a few different ways, but in the village where I've done most of my research, they have this huge set of Buddhist prayer beads. Normally, they just go around your hands. These are big enough to go around an entire room, and they pass these around in their hands as they're chanting Namu Amida Butsu, and they do that for like 20 minutes. And the purpose of that is to help the deceased on wherever they're going to go. People are generally in Japan not very precise about the afterlife. They either don't think there's anything much, or they kind of shrug their shoulders and go, I don't know, maybe you go somewhere. But they don't spend a lot of time really worrying about what the afterlife is. But whatever it might be, there's sort of a sense that it's a journey. And so this Nenbutsu practice is a cult in the academic sense of the term, that it's a non-institutionalized religious activity. That is organized in a way, but it's not tied to any religion, and it's organized at the village level. And I participated in that when I've been doing field work. Actually, I had a very interesting experience with it, because I had learned about it, and so I started asking people about it, and they said, "Well, you know, we'd love to have you come and observe it." And I said, "Oh, great! You know, can I videotape it?" Sure. And so they set it all up to do this. Now, there hadn't been a funeral. And they went to the local meeting house in the center of the village, and they did the ritual. And then we had a big kind of feast afterwards, and all, we all drank beer and did stuff that you do in Japan. And I thought it was pretty interesting. And I recorded it. And then a month or two later, someone died. And so they did the for real. In the second time, and it was, and this is, I think, one of the interesting things about doing ethnographic research, the real one didn't look anything like the staged one. For one thing, in the staged one, they weren't all wearing black, but in the real one, they were all wearing black clothing. And the atmosphere was totally different, and there's no food in the real one. And it was just this really fascinating sort of juxtaposition of representation of the ritual as a kind of spectacle, in a way, a cultural spectacle, and then the actual ritual as it's being done in the context of the people's experience. It actually got me in a little bit of trouble, because when they went to do the ritual, you know, a day or so before, I asked the head of it, I said, "Look, do you mind if I, you know, videotape this?" And he said, "Why do you want to do that? You already videotaped the one we did." And I already had in my head that it probably wasn't going to look quite like the one that was done, that was staged for me. And I said, "Well, you know, I am collecting data here. I'm an ethnographer. That's what I'm doing. And I'd like to videotape it. And he said, well, you're a member of the community. You should be down on the floor doing the ritual with us, representing your household. And it put me in quite a bind. I was trying to figure out, well, what do I do? Do I, you know, collect my data or do I participate and how do I do this? And in the end, I decided to do the video. And he was pissed off at me. Later, he and I talked and he said, yeah, sorry, I got annoyed. I understand why you chose to do that. It does look different. You're right. But at the time, when you're doing ethnographic research, there's this, you know, fascinating problem of your identity as the ethnographer and also your identity as, to some extent, a member of the community who's lived there a year, 2 years, something like that. And you're always kind of walking a tightrope about that. And this is similar to this kind of question about what's the line between fiction and nonfiction and ethnographic writing? Well, there's also this kind of question about what's the identity of the ethnographer? And the book does explore that to some extent. I wanted to get a little bit into that because the ethnographer's identity is tied to the context and it's shifting and changing in relation to the people that you interact with. And so, you know, that studying something, you know, kind of something straightforward, like just wanting to do a video of a ritual that's being done can lead to a bunch of questions about the nature of one's identity as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer doing research.
Yeah, as I was listening to you, I started wondering why they staged the first one like they staged it. Like, is there a expected way to stage it or something?
No, I don't think so. That's a good question. I think it was because, you know, when you're doing ethnographic research, the folks that you're trying to learn from often are just as interested in you as that you are in them. And as I had been there longer, they became interested in trying to help me learn about their culture too. So they wanted to do something. And of course, you can't predict when somebody's going to die. So, you know, they wanted to make sure that I got to see that. And it didn't occur to them at the time that the way it would be done in kind of the staged version would be different from the way it would be done when someone had actually passed on. And like I said, this one guy who was the leader, he realized that afterwards. He kind of was sort of, yeah, I kind of see what you mean about that. They're different. But I think it was out of a genuine desire to make sure that I got the information I was looking for. I often had people do this in the field, where they would think of something they thought was important for me to know and make it a point that I got information about it. And so I think this is an example of that. They were trying to, in some ways, anticipate my needs as a researcher, which, interestingly enough, is very, very typical in Japanese society, where people try to anticipate the needs of others and think about the needs of others. And sometimes the anticipation doesn't quite go the way, you know, it doesn't quite capture what the other might have wanted, because you can't always know. And, you know, the example I often use about this is when I first started going to do research in Japan, I'd go to like a government office and someone would always bring out coffee with cream and sugar in it already. Well, I can't think of any way to ruin a cup of coffee more than to put sugar in it. That is just disgusting. But there was this kind of mindset, you know, if you're an American, you drink coffee with cream and sugar in it. And so they would want to sort of anticipate my need. And it was really very kind. And what I've also noticed is that over the years, they stopped doing that. Now the cream and sugar come on the side. So somewhere along the way, people have recognized that, oh, maybe Americans don't drink coffee with their cream and sugar in it all the time. And so they adjusted things a little bit. But I think it's a part of that same kind of anticipatory interest that you see in Japan, where people try to, you know, think ahead, have their antenna up for the needs of other people and respond to those before those needs are expressed. So I think that's why they actually did that the way they did.
That's very interesting. And now I'd like to turn to your process of writing this novel. You know, since we don't come across a novel in academia every day. So how was the process like writing this novel? I guess, what difficulties did you run into and what parts of it did you enjoy most?
Yeah. So I should start by saying that I have a very strange approach to writing. And I don't do what most people seem to do with writing. So, for example, I have never written an outline in my life. I just sit down and start writing. That's how it works for me. And this particular book, I started a few years ago, and then I got busy and just set it aside. And the pandemic actually contributed to this because I stopped having to drive to and from campus all the time. So I had more time. And then over the winter of, you know, kind of the winter break of 2020 into 2021, I was just home. I couldn't go anywhere or anything like that. So I thought, well, I'm going to go back to this project and see what I can do. And I just got absorbed by it. I found myself waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning with dialogue going through my head, and I just get up and start writing. It got so intense. There was one weekend where I believe I wrote somewhere around 20,000 words, which is roughly a little less than a third of the book. I just couldn't stop writing. And it was enormously fun to write. It was actually a lot more fun to write than typical academic writing. There are some advantages to the using the fiction approach. One advantage is, as my doctoral dissertation advisor Keith Brown said when he read a draft of it, he said, you know, you're kind of released from having to worry about engaging the academic literature on this. You can just explore the topic. And that's true. I didn't have to spend all sorts of time digging through other people's writing about everything because I'm just making a story. So I don't have to triangulate it with all the other stuff that's been written about rural Japan. And that was in some ways kind of liberating because I could simply write what I think, period. That made it enormously fun to write. It was just, you know, intriguing. As I thought about the characters, it got to be a lot of fun. A problem. The biggest problem was finding a publisher. Writing it was kind of easy, but it's a strange book. It's not exactly an ethnography and not exactly not an ethnography. It is fiction, but it's fiction that's very much grounded in a very real thing. And so I had a couple of publishers interested in it. And one was taking a very long time, and they were approaching it more from the perspective of it being an ethnography, but a sort of experimental ethnography. I had quite a few publishers say, wow, this is a really fun book. I enjoyed reading it. Yeah, we don't do that. And so, you know, and I thought, okay, this is very typical academia. Let's never do anything creative. Let's never push the boundaries of anything. We'll just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. This is one of the reasons I wrote the book. I wanted to get away from that. And I had sent off a proposal to Balestier, and I had more or less kind of given up. I was beginning to think, well, I don't know, maybe I'll try like Kindle self-publishing or something like that, because I was the one press that was interested was taking forever, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And they sent me an email and said, we want to publish your book. And I was like, really? Okay. And as I got into talking with them, I was really delighted because they understood what I was trying to do. I would say to kind of aspiring novelists or really anybody who's aspiring to write, it is very important to find a publisher who understands the thing you're trying to accomplish in your writing. Because of course they have their own interests and that can be a challenge to find some, you know, a publisher that really gets it. So that was a challenge, but once that worked out, things were really smooth and went great. So, I mean, all in all, it was just a lot of fun to do this.
That's great to hear. And that sounds so very different from academic writing.
Yes.
Yeah. Now that you have experience with both, do you have a preference between the two?
Oh, absolutely. I'd much prefer to write novels for the rest of my life, which is, in fact, pretty much what I plan to do. I'm going to retire in, like 3 years. And so I don't have any particular need to continue writing standard academic. I mean, I'll publish things, I'm sure, as stuff comes up that's interesting. But I find this type of writing a lot more fun. And so I'd like to develop the skill and get better at it.
Well, Well, I'm very jealous of that. I wish I could just write 23,000 words of my dissertation over one weekend, or just tell my advisor that I decided to not write a novel instead of a dissertation.
But see, here's an interesting question. Why can't you write a novel instead of a dissertation and build a novel around something that adds to knowledge? Why do we have to, in the academic world, be so confined by the conventions of the way we do things? And I think from an intellectual perspective, we should be much more interested in finding ways to disrupt convention. And that's part of what I wanted to do with this, is to find a way to disrupt convention when we think about ethnographic writing and think about writing about Japan. I actually think it's kind of unfortunate that everything has become so formulaic. I mean, maybe it's been formulaic for a long time. But when I look at the way academic writing works, it's each different field has its own formula. And your job in graduate school is to learn the formula. And then you go off and you rinse, wash, and repeat 12,000 times, and then you retire. And that is not a recipe for creativity, in my view. And I think that's actually a very serious problem with the academic world. There's very little room for creativity.
And how does your years of experience working in academia manifesting this novel? We talked about this problem with maybe lack of encouragement of creativity. What else have you injected into this novel from your 30 years of experience in academia?
Unfortunately, some of my cynicism, I'm afraid, has been injected into it. It comes through here and there. I think part of that it happens as Jack thinks about his retirement and thinks about his experience with colleagues over the years and that sort of thing. I've been very fortunate. I've had wonderful colleagues throughout most of my career. But there are things in the academic world, and I did build these into Jack's character intentionally that I find annoying at times. And one of those things is the status hierarchies related to things like where you went to graduate school. I was fortunate. I went to an Ivy League school for my master's degree, but I went to the University of Massachusetts at Lowell for my undergraduate degree. At the time, it was a commuter school. I got an absolutely stellar education there with professors, many of whom didn't even have PhDs at the time, but who were just superb teachers and really got me to think. And then I did my PhD at Pitt, which is a state-related university, but, you know, it's not an Ivy League school. And I have certainly at times found the status hierarchies in academia to be both troubling and very pompous. And so I built that into his character. He has a certain irritation and resistance to that. And I think there's an unwillingness of Jack to assume the kind of stereotypical academic persona. And I think that's actually a manifestation of my own resistance to academic snobbery. And so, you know, that was there. I'm curious, what do you think? And, you know, what did you think about Jack or the novel in relation to that? What did, as someone reading about it, as an academic, how did you respond to that? I'd be very curious to know.
I thought he was a very observant person. I mean, that's mm-hmm. definitely, some traits from his, ethnographic study background. But I suppose the way that we see things through how we see what was happening in the village with the murders, mm-hmm. And the ritual, they were all through Jack's view, Jack's right. perspective. And that kind of detailed careful description can only come through with enough experience of ethnography training.
Yeah, and what it also does is it reminds someone thinking about this that the books you read about other cultures are actually books about the eyes of the person observing the other culture. And often we conflate that. We say, this is a book about another culture. But it's really not. It's a book about Jack looking at the other culture. That's what we see when we see ethnography. And, you know, one of the greatest examples of this is the cornerstone of Japan studies, Ruth Benedict's The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, which, you know, have you ever read any of the book reviews that came out after that?
Yes, I have.
They're fascinating. They all assume she did a study of Japan, but she didn't. She did a study of Japanese Americans in concentration camps in the desert. But it's fascinating to look at how her view got constructed as Japan instead of what it is, a view of Japanese Americans in a terribly difficult situation, sort of kind of talking about their understanding of Japan. And I think that's really important for people to keep in mind when they read about other cultures, that you're always reading the perspective of the author. You're not reading about the culture itself.
Yeah, that's a really great point. So what's your next project, MFB? What's your next novel, I guess, will be about?
Well, I'm going to write a sequel to this. That's next. I started on it already a little bit and then got kind of sidetracked. I finished another book while I was writing this. I wrote another book that's kind of an intellectual memoir. It's called Embracing Uncertainty, and it gets into my thinking as an anthropologist and having, you know, spent a lot of time in Japan and also traveled to many other places. It's more into what I think you can learn from studying other cultures and having the experience of being in other places. And so that came out over the summer. You know, basically, I think probably the next project is really to try to take what I've done with the Jack character and develop it further, and to develop my skill as a novelist further. That's really, I think, what will be the future for me.
Nice. I'll be looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for this wonderful conversation, for this super interesting book.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your having me on, and I've enjoyed our conversation, and hope people will find the book interesting.
Yeah, definitely hope so. For our listeners to find out the rest of Jack Ridley's adventure, make sure you check out this new book, The Blood of Gutoku, A Jack Ridley Mystery in Japan, by John Trepagan. I am Jing Yi from New Books in Japanese Studies, and I will see you soon.